Welcome to episode 78. Today's offering dips back to March 17th and 18th of 1996. Based on birds, callers, and guests in this installment, I have titled it Mystery and Magic. The producers are Mike Cannon and Tom Howie. 18-year-old Mike training 22-year-old Tom during a time of revolving door producers on the show, which Norm explains so well during a call. We begin with Norm riffing on a few subjects. I think we have a moment here where Norm is waiting for calls and is just going through news and info. I found it especially comforting just listening to Norm shuffle papers and tell us little stories and factoids from the wires. Simply soothing. St. Patrick's Day, birds migrating, the swallows returning to Capistrano, and Motown returning to Detroit are talked about here. We take some very interesting calls. Ruth Clennett gives us her review of Mr. Holland's Opus. Now Norm, you see, has not been able to see many movies as he's an advisor to the president as well as the State Department. He does a lot of traveling around the world, putting things in order. She talks about community auditions where she was the auditioner, if that's a word, for 25 years. Norm helps clear things up when Ruth inquires about someone featured in the movie. She also talks about Riverdance. This, of course, was the early phase of the Riverdance phenomenon. She also said she heard Norm and I talking to Robert from Everett the previous night and was wholly entertained. Norm? Yeah, not so much. And their banter closes with a job offer for Ruth. The next call is from June in Brookline, sidewalk game reporter and observer of the American scene. I will not give any more away, as this is quite the call, and I swear Norm is trying his hardest not to break out in laughter through most of it. After the call, we only hear the first few words of a commercial, but it is so appropriate. We now hear from Sarah, I believe, and learn about schlemiels and schlemazels, and more Yiddish expressions. Mary Lou from Lowell, first-time caller and thrilled to talk to Norm. We learn of Lord Briscoe, the Jewish man with the Irish brogue. Next up is Don, with lots of talk about trains. Then we get a great call from John in Allentown, Pennsylvania, lover of old-time radio and is majoring in radio and TV. This being a subject right up Norm's alley, he dives into it and wishes radio was like that again. John agrees and says it is with the dumb birthday game. That concludes our March 17th broadcast. We now cut to March 18th. Norm teases the upcoming guests, Steve Daly, author of Toy Story, The Art and Making of the Animated Film, and later, Charles Solomon, animation historian and author of The Disney That Never Was. Before that, we are joined by Lenny Sokoloff from Lenny's on the Turnpike. A few great stories are shared. Lenny driving down Morrissey Boulevard with an artist heading over to Norm's show in the early a.m. hours to hang out. Count Basie, the Turnpike Club, Norm's unpaid bar tab, and more. Lenny, still promoting jazz off and on, had something coming up with Grover Mitchell leading the Count Basie Band. They were going to be appearing at the Temple Emmanuel in Marblehead. There'll be dancing and refreshments, so don't miss it! Our next guest, who had no problem holding while the jazz talk was going on, because he's a jazz fan, was Steve Daly, the staff writer for Entertainment Weekly and the co-author of Toy Story, The Art and Making of the Animated Film. Now, that's a book I believe I still have here in the vault. Toy Story was the first full-length animated film made entirely on computer. There's tons of interesting info on the whole process and story. We then turn to the next guest, Charles Solomon, author of The Disney That Never Was. There's only about 10 minutes of the interview here, and that's a shame, but it's still worth a listen. Episode 78, Mystery and Magic, begins now.
Amazing, isn't it? Most people can't figure out how birds migrate, how they know where to go. You know, and yet they do it. They migrate each year and come back again. But what about like the buzzards, the turkey vultures that return to Hinckley, Ohio, as they do each March 15th? And the swallows that come back to Capistrano. Do you remember that song? You old enough to remember the song? When the swallows come back to Capistrano, that's the day I promise to come back to you. One of the prettiest songs I think I ever wrote. Thank you. Anyway, San Juan Capistrano, one of the state's oldest towns, the summer house of cliff swallows. and the arrival of the birds at the end of a 6,000-mile migration from Argentina has been celebrated for generations on March 19th. But this time, I guess they came. Oh, the tourists are there now. But I guess they showed up in they showed up a little bit early. They showed up on the 16th. But isn't that amazing? They go from California to Argentina and back again. That instinct that they have. The bells of the town's historic mission have chimed to welcome them for the Feast of St. Joseph. But this year, local officials and merchants decided to observe Swallow Day early to accommodate weekend tourists. Oh, I guess the birds haven't showed up, only the tourists. I should read these items all the way through before I throw them at you. It says, a spokesman for the mission says hardly anyone believes any more that the birds actually show up punctually March 19th. This morning, which would have been Saturday morning, several swallows were spotted flitting above the mission. I guess they didn't all, a whole lot of them didn't show up, just a few. And maybe the bulk of them over the weekend. Oh, incidentally, I don't need to tell you that this is St. Patrick's Day, by the way. We'll talk about that as the night goes on. And a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I always like St. Patrick's Day for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a lovely, happy time of year, and it's a fun kind of holiday. And number two, it's another signifying mark about the fact that spring is on its way. Thank you just so very much. And let me see, what else can I tell you about? I can tell you about a whole bunch of stuff. I'll tell you about those as we go along. But meantime, I'd like to just flap some papers in your ear. Motown is returning to the Motor City. Remember the Motown sound? A lot of the Motown groups, rhythm and blues kind of groups that originated out of Detroit. 24 years after jilting Detroit and moving to Los Angeles, the music company that once transformed artists from the city's housing projects into superstars is coming home. I mention this because we have a fair amount of listeners in Detroit who can hear us, and apparently they're going to... Detroit won't be the main city for Motown music that it was in the past because they moved out to Los Angeles. But the new Motown president says that Detroit will serve as the Midwest headquarters for Motown, and they'll still be looking for talent in that area. I don't know why I'm telling you this, because I don't know. When I started this, I thought it'd be something you'd be interested in, but I can tell the way you're looking at me, maybe not. Let me do the weather and stuff, and then we'll take some phone calls. Okay, we have just one open line right now. WBZ's extended AccuWeather forecast from Dave Bowers and his Motown Recording Orchestra. Clear overnight, brisk and cold, with the low temperatures about 26. Right now it's 27 degrees, and it is windy, and it just hits you. After the lovely weather, it just really feels cold. Sunday, sunshine and a few clouds, highs 46. Sunday night, clear to partly cloudy, lows 30. Monday, a mixture of clouds and sun, highs 46. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy, becoming windy, with rain arriving later in the day. It may start as snow, highs 40 degrees. Thank you very much. I do appreciate your kind attention. And now, I'd like to lie down. Get silly. Ruth in hello.
Hello.
Hello, Ruth.
Another new producer.
Are
you doing something over there?
No, what happens is new young people are break in on this program, because I told you this is the bottom rung of the ladder. And as soon as they get to be really good at it, they're then transferred to another shift.
I get
the train. I don't really train them personally, but I get to be in on the beginnings of their elaborate careers. And as soon as they know what they're doing, they're gone. So I get another badge. I should be saying this because the producer's looking at me, and he can detect that that's a dig.
Is he older than the last one?
This one is 22 years old. And
oh, yeah, I heard him the other night.
Yeah, but he's being trained by an 18-year-old.
Yes, I heard him.
Yeah, as soon as they get of age, they'll do the David Brednoy show, and then I'll get a 12-year-old who's never been in a radio studio before.
Anyway.
Yes.
I just heard the end of that lady's interview, and I want you to know I went to the movies alone today.
Did you make a little notebook?
And nobody stared at me. What can I do? But I'm giving you my Mr. Holland's Opus report.
Okay, that's the movie you saw this very day.
You didn't see it, right?
No, I really want to see it.
I want you to go and see it. You will love it.
Well, that's right, too. I said I want to see it, but I don't know that I want to see it until you tell me that.
You will love it. You will love it. Really.
More and more people have called and talked about that movie, as a matter of fact.
It surprised me because a lot of the songs that they did play in it, which I didn't expect to see, especially Louie Louie. Remember that? Louie Louie?
Oh, yes.
It used to be our record hop song.
Yeah.
That was one of the major songs. But, I mean, everyone's talking about Nicolas Cage winning the Academy Award, of course, for Leaving Las Vegas, which I didn't see. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen much of anything.
I haven't either. This is my first opportunity. And but he really should win the Academy Award for Mr. Holland's Opus because he just was wonderful. Just wonderful.
And the person you're talking about is Richard Dreyfuss. I don't think we mentioned his name.
Right, correct. I'm sorry. I'm not giving a great report. I'm tired tonight. Yeah, but it really was a very, very good movie. You will enjoy it. I wouldn't give it like a 5, but I give it like 4. There's just a little things here and there. And the Boston papers have only given it 2.5 stars. Well, what do they know, right?
They don't know. If they knew, they'd be television people. They'd
That's
be
right.
television critics.
That's right.
Yeah.
But also, an interesting thing. Now, if anybody knows the answer to this question, I wish they would call and tell you, even though I'm your reporter. A young lady in the middle of the movie, I'm not going to give away the whole thing, but the girl who sings the best, I understand there was a write-up in some papers around here saying that she was on community auditions. Now, since I was the auditionee for 25 years, I don't recognize her name. I don't recognize anything about her. And somebody else I know in Florida also said there was a story about her down there because her mother is living there or something, and also said she was on community auditions. And I want to know if anybody knows anything about that. Her name was something like Susan something Kelly.
Susan with a middle name, Kelly.
Right. And I have, you know, I mean, after all, I did, you know, if somebody sang as well as that young lady sang, and I did really audition maybe 50, 60,000 acts in my time, but the ones who stood out, you know, I could name them all for you right now.
Well, I can tell you right now why you didn't recognize her. And she was on community auditions, but she was under the name...
Michelle Pfeiffer.
No, Henry Moscovich. She was a man at that time and has only become a woman recently. And if you watched daytime television, you would have known that.
On the Ricky Lake Show. Right?
And any one of them. They all do transvestites and all of that stuff.
Well, the thing is, though, she might have been 4 or 5 years old but at the time because she looks about maybe in her 20s now. But even so, if she sang that well, you know, had a good voice when she was 4 or 5, I think I have a pretty good memory. So anyway, if anybody knows, that would be good. Now, the other question I have for you is, did you see on any shows this week a group called River Dance?
I have not.
Oh, I have to tell you. The other night, David Letterman started with David Letterman, and he said he was going to have this group, River Dance. Well, you know, he always has rock groups on and everything, and out came Irish step dance group of maybe, I'm not going to say it correctly, but maybe between 20 and 30 people from Ireland who had gone to England and did some shows there. And I want to tell you, in all my days, I have never seen anybody dance the way they did.
I saw the promotion on that.
Absolutely.
I didn't see them on the show, but they were really hopping around at a really brisk pace.
And yesterday morning, they were on the Today Show, and they were out in the middle of Fifth Avenue or wherever they broadcast from there. And they said they've been at Radio City Music Hall this week. I'm giving you a good entertainment report, aren't I?
That's wonderful.
And they They are just doing standing room only business. They did in London and here. They're just absolutely magnificent.
Mm.
Maybe girls in beautiful little costumes and guys in black outfits. And I've never seen anybody dance like that in my entire life.
I thought the women were kind of attractive and kind of leggy, which is really nice.
Well, it started off on David Letterman's because he has such a big stage there with just a fellow and a girl. And they danced for maybe 2 or 3 minutes by themselves. And it was like watching ice skating on taps, you know, one of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then they all joined in. And it's the first time on the David Letterman show in all the years I've watched it, every person in the studio audience stood up and applauded. At the end,
he
got a standing ovation. It was really great.
Oh, my goodness. Are they appearing other places, do you know?
That's always said, Radio City Music Hall, because of St. Patrick.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Well, that's good. No, that's the answer then.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So that was my report, and I heard you and Tony speaking to Robert last night. That was fun.
Sure. You sadistic human being.
And that's my report.
Okay, well, I appreciate that very much.
I want you to go to the movies and see Mr. Holland's Opus.
I do want to see that. There's several others I've wanted to see, too. And I just have not gotten to it. As you know, I'm an advisor to the president and a State Department, State Department advisor also. And I do a lot of traveling around the world, putting things in order. Sometimes I don't have time to go to the movies.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you, though, your Michelle Pfeiffer or Robert Redford movie's not getting very good comments.
Well, I know that, but you haven't seen it yet, so I don't want you quoting other people.
Okay, I'm just telling you, but I got the soundtrack. I got the new Celine Dion cassette this week, and she does the background music on, and the songs are already number one in about 10 days.
Well, I think that's just so swell.
The music from the movie.
I see.
So we'll have to check that out very soon, and I'll call it in.
That's right. You don't need to quote other people. Here's the thing. I want to brief you on this thing, Ruth. You want to be my entertainment reporter. Number one, don't quote other people until you've seen the movie, because I care for your opinion more than I do for theirs.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and that's a heavy responsibility, and I hope you don't buckle on that.
Have you sent me a check?
Of course not. I work for Westinghouse.
Oh. Okay.
I've learned from them.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, bye-bye. Okay. Let's go to, how about June in Brookline? Hi, June.
Hi.
Norm. Norm is my name, and I'm glad to talk with you. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
Thanks.
What can I do for you?
Well, I thought you might be interested in a game I saw someone playing today on the sidewalk. It was probably a BU student, 18 or so.
Uh-huh.
Female.
Yeah.
And she had a soccer ball that was encased in twine. On a tether. A leash.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That she held in her hand. And so as she was going along, she could kick it, and it wouldn't run away from her. Now, I don't know if this is on sale or if she invented it herself, but anyone who has a soccer ball could make one of those things for themselves.
What was the point of the game, though, besides kicking it and having it not get away from
fun.
Her? I see.
Practice kicking and
just going around kicking a soccer ball wouldn't get away from you because it's tied to you.
Yeah, or run into the traffic or, trip anybody else on the sidewalk.
I don't know. Somehow I can't get thrilled by somebody just kicking a soccer ball and I thought there must be some point to a game. Somebody
well,
you can score
young,
points
you
with.
Maybe you enjoy kicking a ball. But
I suppose so.
If you've already kicked a ball so many times, it's not fun no more. Well, that's
no, I don't know.
Story.
Well, no, maybe you get somebody else who'll be at the other end, and kick the ball at them, and they'll kick the ball back at you. At least there'll be kind of a togetherness for a couple of people. But just standing around kicking a ball all by yourself.
No, not standing around, but as you're walking along, going from one place to another.
Oh, I see.
How
long was this tether?
Oh, let's see, 5-6 feet.
Oh, I see. Not too far. So the ball didn't get away too far.
Right. And as you're walking along, you could kick it and.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I may put that together. And each time when the news is on during the hour when I can take a break, I may, as I go to the water fountain, mm-hmm. I can just kick a soccer ball along.
Or even in the chair.
Even while I'm here, that's true. I could, yeah, right. Hold on a minute. Let me check. I don't, yeah, well, I suppose we, there's I'm kind of hedged in here by equipment and stuff. But I we could probably find a place where I could just sit around kicking a soccer ball.
You know, a few years ago, I saw a little kid on one of those sidewalk tricycles made of plastic.
Uh-huh.
And his parent, I guess, his father, or a store, had provided it with like a broom handle at the back.
Uh-huh.
That the parent could hold on to. So this way the child didn't go off the curve or run into elderly people or anything.
Golly,
could still ride his or her little bike.
Golly gee, because Joan, you are an observer of the American scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing.
Yes.
Here's a game I invented for the sidewalk in wintertime.
Yes.
You take an icicle and break it in half so that you have two pieces. And then you kick each one with one foot, alternating feet as you go down the sidewalk. Instead of kicking one piece of ice, you have two pieces, and there's one for each foot.
Oh, June.
The city game.
June.
You know, any age can play who's steady on their feet.
That's right. One size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta go, June. That is the silliest thing I've ever heard.
Stop for a minute.
Is that a Schlemiel is so clumsy that he knocks drinks over, and a Schlemazel is the person that the drinks fall on.
That's right.
You've heard that.
Yeah, I remember it now, but I was trying to think of it when the word came up, and I couldn't think of that joke, which I think is funny. But there's a book, Philip Roth wrote a book on Yiddish. Have you seen that? It's an encyclopedia of Yiddish, and he explains all these terms. I've got that at home, and I'm not very good at filing stuff, and I never can find things when I want them. But he's got a lot of that, like Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Schlepper, which is different than Schlep. A Schlepper is a...
It's not a carrier.
Not a carrier. That's right. It should be, but it's not.
But it's not.
No, as a matter of fact, in Yiddish, there are a whole lot of expressions that, if translated literally, have nothing whatever to do with anything. There's a word, for example. Are you Jewish, by the way? You know Yiddish at all?
Well, I am, but I don't know. I really don't know Yiddish.
No, I don't. I'm Jewish, and I don't know that many phrases. But for example, you hear phrases like "Don't huck me a chinik," which translated literally means "Don't hit me off the head with a pot."
Right.
But that doesn't mean, that is not what it's used for. What it means is, you know, don't bug me with this loud, you keep whining and complaining kind of stuff.
Right. Stop nagging.
Yeah, stop nagging. I think that's a better way to phrase it. But there are a lot of phrases. I would think that's probably true in a whole lot of languages, where it certainly is true in English, where we have colloquial expressions that if you that don't mean what they mean literally. They don't. I mean, they used to express some other thought. I'm trying to think of an English expression like that.
Well, a greenhorn? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. There may be some roots for all of that kind of stuff. A greenhorn is somebody who's new and hasn't really become acquainted with the ways of a society as yet. He's still kind of new to that society, and is kind of almost like we call him a farmer or something like, which is probably not fair to farmers. But there are expressions, but I hayseed, yeah.
Yeah.
See, you have a better way of summing things up than I do. And this is supposed to be my business, and I'm really rotten at that. That's kind of, you're shaming me.
No, I enjoy listening.
Okay. Hey, I appreciate that, Sally. That's kind of funny. We'll have to have a whole program on Yiddish, because I think maybe because I don't know the language. I really don't know it well, but I know a few phrases, and those few phrases are so descriptive and so wonderful that it's kind of fun to use them. But you have to, and there's no way you can explain them.
Right.
And that, I'm sure that's, I know that's true in every language. There must be some great ones in Irish and in Gaelic, rather, and Italian and French, that when translated don't seem to make any sense at all.
Maybe some of your listeners will call in and tell us some.
I think so. Yeah, we'll be going off the air in about 20 minutes. We won't have too much time, but maybe that would be a great topic for some night. We can spend an hour or so just doing that. I think it'd be fun. Anyway, thank you for the joke, and I appreciate you filling in an area that I just just went out of my head totally.
Good to listen to you.
Thanks a lot, Sally.
Right.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's go to Mary Lou in Lowell. Hi, Mary Lou.
Oh, I'm so thrilled, absolutely thrilled to be talking to you.
Oh, gee whiz, Mary Lou. Stop it.
I'm a first-time caller.
I'm glad you called. Thank you.
And I just wanted to tell you, I am a Polish descent myself, but when I was a single school teacher, I used to travel to Ireland during the summers, and it was my favorite place to vacation. Mm. And there was an Irish Lord Mayor of Cork of the Jewish persuasion, and his last name was Briscoe.
Briscoe, that's the guy. That's the guy. I couldn't think of his name. That's right.
Yeah, B-R-I-S-C-O-E.
I remember when he came to this country. It's kind of funny. We kind of stereotype people. And yet, whatever religion you are, you can live in any country. It's true that in Ireland, and most people are Irish. I know there's the Irish and the Protestant problems and all that kind of stuff. But like in Poland, most people are Catholic. In England, most people are Protestants, and so on. But that isn't, exclusive. You can be English and you can be Catholic, and you can be Irish and be Catholic, and be Protestant. It doesn't usually happen. So you can be Jewish and still be Irish. And Briscoe came here, and of course talked Irish because he was Irish.
Mm-hmm.
He had a brogue, he had red hair, and the whole business. and people were astounded by all of that, the fact that he wasn't a stereotype. Maybe I'm not phrasing it quite correctly, but they couldn't believe he was Jewish if he had an Irish brogue, and there's no reason why not. His nationality was Irish, even though his religion was not. But that was his name. Was it Lord Briscoe? That's how they call him now, or
Lord
something.
Lord Mayor?
No, but Briscoe was his last name. I do remember that.
Yep.
And somebody told me that there was a mayor of Rome at one time, whose last name was the same as mine, Nathan. I found that hard to accept because there is no TH sound in Italian. So I don't know, I remember I used to introduce an Italian language announcer, a very dear man, and he did the whole program in Italian. I would say, now here he is, here's your host. I forget, his name was Salimene. Yeah, this is way back. And I'd, Signor Salimene, Mr. And then he would take it to say, Grazie, Signor Nathan. Because he couldn't pronounce the TH because that's not part of Italian. So what am I talking about? Have you any idea, Mary Lou? I think I went off the track here somewhere.
Well, I think in Gaelic, too, they don't pronounce the THs.
In what language?
In Gaelic.
In Gaelic, yes. they don't have a TH either, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that, I was thinking of, do they have a TH in Welsh? Welsh, they have about 9,000 letters. It's like Denmark, Danish. Unless you're born there, nobody can ever learn Gaelic, I don't think, or Welsh, or Danish. Those are such impossible languages to learn. But it's an interesting study, though, anyway. I'm rambling on in a really stupid, meaningless way. I appreciate you reminding me of Lord Briscoe. I'd forgotten, as you heard, I've just had forgotten about his name. And I think he was the one who was trying to switch the people, or at least to get them to drink more milk. I think he was part of that campaign at the time. Maybe that's why he never got reelected. I don't know.
Right.
Hey, thank you very much, Marlo. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, too.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Yeah, one is this morning is the one, I guess, with Billy Bulger will be at the in South Boston with his annual St. Patrick's Day.
They had an animated cartoon of a new train that's supposed to run from Boston down the Northeast Corridor.
Yes.
and Bombardier is supposed to make them. You know, Bombardier is made the trains for Montreal, and they also made the Articats and the Ski-Doos. That's their claim to fame. And they made the LRVs for the Portland, Oregon transit system and the new Red Line trains.
Okay. Now, when are they supposed to be put into effect?
1997. They have to electrify the Northeast Corridor. That's the only. That's one of the reasons why it's slow, because if you take a train, the electrification runs from New Haven all the way down to Washington. And when the Northeast train gets to New Haven, they have to switch engines.
Mm.
And that takes anywhere from, they say half hour, but sometimes 45 minutes. They have to run an engine out of the yard, hook it on. Then they say if the train is, say 10 cars long, they tell everybody in the first two cars or the last two cars that goes up Springfield up that way. And they say if you're going beyond that, everybody get in the last two cars, et cetera. They do a lot of detaching cars. Like when you go west to Chicago, when you get to Rensselaer, the train from Boston to Chicago stops and it picks up the cars that are coming out from New York City. People who want to go from New York to Chicago, their cars have to be detached in Rensselaer to go west.
Mm.
When you're coming east, they do the opposite. They say everybody going to New York City and points get on the last two cars. So the train comes east from Chicago through Pennsylvania to up New York State. When it gets to Rensselaer, he detaches the cars.
Mm.
And the cars either hooked on a train from Albany down to New York City or a train from Toronto or Montreal.
Do we have tracks that are in good enough shape to take a train going 150 miles an hour?
No, they have to redo them.
So it's not just a question of a train that can go that fast. The question of having the tracks to be able to accommodate them.
Yeah.
Right? Is that it sounds like a huge job to have to do that, is it?
Yes, it is. It's especially in our quadrant, because I think the fastest trains in the Northeast, I mean, outside of Europe, I think are in the Philadelphia area. My sister used to live in Philadelphia. We took a train to Harrisburg, which is 104 miles away, and the train did it in an hour and 55 minutes.
Hmm.
And those trains were in Philadelphia. They have the fastest rapid transit. They have the Norristown train. That does 75 miles an hour. And that's a transit. It does all local stops. So.
Well, wouldn't it be great if you pick up a train in Boston, say you're going to New York, and you get a train that goes 150 miles an hour? What'd that take you? You could, and you'd end up right in the city. That would be a faster trip than by plane.
Yes. They found that out in Europe, too, because, in this country, it's meant as it is. Like, if you're going to California, naturally, you take a plane. But Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, if you're over in Europe, you're going through three or four different countries. And they're roughly, the same distance as Providence and Boston. So a train like that fast could get there faster than a plane, because logically you can't take a plane from Providence to Logan. But if you take a plane from Logan to New York City, you have to get out to Logan, whether by rapid transit or by cab. You have to wait for the plane to taxi out, hit New York City or Kennedy. Then you have to wait for a cab or a plane to take you back into the city again.
That's right. Yeah, so a train would make more sense than a train going at that speed. I don't know. Do you see the you see that coming about?
They have to redo the track, straighten them out.
Yeah, but I mean, does anybody have the ambition to do that? Is there anybody touting for that kind of a thing, or is that a lost cause?
Well, it's contracted out already to what they call ABB, which is a Swedish concern, and Bombardier, and they already make these, they make these trains over in Europe.
No, but aside from that, I realize that you had mentioned that, but does anybody have the ambition to back the remaking of the tracks and stuff so they can handle the speed of trains like that?
Well, you know, Norm, I think there's a market for it because I went down to Philadelphia.
No, I'm sure there is a market for it. I just wonder whether anybody's... I don't hear anybody say anything like that about, we must institute fast rail travel and all that. I wonder if anybody really cares.
Well, the government owns it. They, like in Europe, the government owns most of the railroad, and they're trying to keep people from using their automobiles. And it's so bad, like when you go down on a three-day weekend or a holiday, there are people standing, college kids actually laying on the floor. I mean, I've never seen that in Europe. You have to step over and you think you're in a college dormitory.
Where's this? You're talking about
this? This is a northeast, our northeast train going from between Boston and Point South to Washington.
Okay, so you're saying there is a market for this?
Yes, especially.
Okay, well, I hope so. I've got to move along, but I hope that happens.
Okay, Norm.
I would love to see 150-mile-an-hour trains, safe trains going from here to wherever. It would make a whole lot of sense, I guess. I don't know how much financial sense it would make since I'm not the one financing it, but I hope that happens. Anyway, thanks a lot for the information, Don. John in Pennsylvania. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for hanging in there. I'm sorry to keep you waiting so long.
No problem. I just appreciate the show.
Thank you.
It's clear weather tonight, and somehow I got a Boston station.
Now, where in Pennsylvania are you?
Allentown. It's about 50 miles north of Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. We get a fair amount of calls from people from that specific area.
Really?
Of Pennsylvania, yeah. Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania and Philadelphia both have Westinghouse stations that are very close to us on the dial. So people in those areas, we're kind of blocked out by the local stations. But around Allentown, Harrisburg, in that general area, we seem to do a little bit better.
Yeah, I'm always on a constant quest for old-time radio shows.
Oh, really?
You don't usually find them, but...
No, we haven't done that here either. I do a talk on old-time radio.
Yeah.
With this is not on the air, but this is, before groups, and with excerpts of those old shows and discussions, all that kind of stuff. What kind of old-time radio do you like?
Well, you don't really find any, but...
Do you collect the tapes at all? Because there's a lot of it on cassettes now.
I've listened to a few. That's my major in the area right now. I'm majoring in radio, TV, and film.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So I have a history of broadcasting class, and I've just been listening to a lot of AM radio. I have an antique radio, and I've been trying to find some of those and just build up.
Oh, yeah. There's a New England Antique Radio Club here. I imagine there may very well be up in your area, I would think.
Yeah.
No. I know there is one here, and they have auctions and sales and all going on where you can pick up old-time radios, and they give you an idea where you can pick up the tubes and everything to put them in shape.
Yeah.
Yours works pretty good. What kind of a radio is it?
It's an Emerson. It's from 1947, but it's got the new FM. It's not the old 45 to 60, I think, is what the old FM was. So it's a vacuum tube radio. Found it at a yard sale for about $10.
Oh, yeah. And was it working when you got it?
Yeah, it works. It's just missing two knobs, which are impossible to find.
Oh, yeah. But more and more people seem to be interested in that stuff. I think it would maybe end up like old-time cars.
Yeah.
Where there are companies who manufacture, can duplicate the equipment for old-time cars so that you can always get stuff to fix it up.
Right. I really think there's a lot of people my age that would really be into it, especially listen to the radio. If you have an interesting show kind of like yours or Garrison Keillor, it keeps you awake on the highway. I mean...
Oh, thank you. That's nice. We do get a lot of calls from young people, particularly, very often musicians who are on their way home from a gig or, to actors or whatever. And there are some old-time radio shows that are really quite good and that do hold up very nicely, mostly the class acts like Jack Benny and Fred Allen.
Right.
And some of the early Henry Morgan stuff, a lot of people are not aware of Henry Morgan, or if they are, they think of him as a guy sitting in on these panel shows as he did on television later. But that the early Henry Morgan was really off the wall and really nutty. I mean, he'd make Saturday Night Live look like, I don't know, the Longines Symphonette. Or I can't think of another comparable thing. But there was some incredibly good, a lot of boring stuff, too, that was not so great.
Right.
But I play some of the stuff in the thing that I do, and there's some Fred Allen stuff that could have been written this morning, and you would find it hard to believe
that
was broadcast like 50 and 60 years ago.
Well, it's all timeless. We're still using cliches from then. So.
Well, I mean, this was incredibly clever humor, and Benny, well, he was the same Benny, you know, he was in later years in television. A lot of those shows are really incredibly good. They amaze you. They're so good because when you listen to them, you expect, you know, well, this is 50, 60 years old. How timely? How can it? It must sound really dated.
Right.
And a lot of it really does not. No. A lot of it does, but a lot of it sounded bad even when it was new.
Right. One of the old tapes I got to listen to was Burns and Allen.
They remain pretty much the same right up through the repeats that you see the reruns on television now.
Right.
Fibber McGee and Molly had some funny moments.
He was the one with the closet, right?
Yeah, he was the one. Yeah. Yeah. Let me just check, Molly. Let me get to that. No, don't open the closet, Fibber McGee. Anyway, and the fun thing was, you know, you're imagining what was pouring out of this closet.
Right.
Because they were on television for a little bit during the early days of television. They showed the closet. And it wasn't funny anymore.
No,
you know, you didn't want to see it. You just wanted to hear it, you know, and imagine yourself what was coming out.
Right.
That was, you know, one of the great things. I think just the idea that you could use your imagination and have kind of your mind was the theater, you know, where this movie played in your mind, you imagined it. It made it a great deal of fun.
Yeah. And I think especially now, radio has seemed to move over into cars, especially in the morning with commutes. I think besides news, you'd really have a lot of people paying attention because you don't. It's not as visual, obviously, as TV, and you can imagine it. Just that it can be in the background and it can be, you know.
No, that's true. A lot of things you could imagine in a funnier way than you could ever depict it. There's one skit too that Fred Allen is going in for to get a tuxedo, and I won't even repeat the lines, but the thing is absolutely hilarious, and there's no way you can show a tuxedo and a guy being fitted that would be as funny as what you picture in your mind from just the words that you hear them say.
Right.
Anyway, that was the charm of the radio. Like I said, the cliche is the theater of the mind and all of that kind of stuff. But basically, that's what it was.
Do you ever get to play those shows on the air?
You know, it's kind of funny. Back when I was doing an all-night jazz show back in the, way back in the late 50s, they were not releasing them on cassette. I don't think they even had tape in the late 50s. So maybe it was just beginning. In any event, there was a guy who would send away for these on big discs, which is the only way you could get these old radio shows.
Right, right.
And I was playing them on the air as part of this jazz show, this all-night jazz show I was doing. And it got to be tremendously popular, so popular that the management of that station made me stop playing it, which is kind of funny because he thought if nobody noticed at 2 o'clock in the morning I was playing this stuff, it was okay. But now people were noticing, and he was worried about the copyrights and you know, who owned the shows, and we'd get sued. So we had to stop doing it. So I did it back then, and in more recent years, there have been other people, now that they're much more accessible on tape, on cassettes and all, more of the guys have been playing it on occasion. You still don't hear an awful lot of it. And some of it that they play is not terribly funny, like the Great Gildersleeve, and there are tons of others that older people remember with fond memories, but if you hear them, you have to say, that really wasn't funny.
Right.
Jack Benny was funny, Fred Allen, all these other things we're talking about. And some of the mystery shows were kind of interesting, too. Some great writers, I'm telling you, and you're taking a whole course in this, but there was a writer named Arch Obler
Okay. The Fall of the City, did he write?
Yes, he did. He did one movie also. I don't remember ever seeing that, or if I did, I don't recall it. But he wrote radio drama. I thought was a genius. I thought he did some absolutely fantastic work.
Right.
That I guess would hold up today. Then they were tongue-in-cheek kind of shows like Vic and Sade and of course, Bob and Ray, who originated here in Boston, I thought were one of the best exports we ever had from Boston. They were great.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was radio did some wonderful things, and I'm sorry that we're not doing such wonderful things anymore.
That's the stupid birthday game. I think that's very wonderful.
Okay. I just think at this time of the day, maybe people are tired of people screaming politics at each other, and maybe we ought to just giggle a little bit every now and then.
People need to talk more.
What do you plan to do with this communications course and all the stuff that you're doing?
Well, I don't know. That's the cool thing about it is you can do just about anything. So I like shooting video. I like editing. I also like audio because I'm a musician as well. So I think it leaves a lot of opportunities open, and I just like to do whatever keeps me happy. So
I wish you a great deal of luck, John. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I hope we can talk again soon.
I hope I can still pick you up later.
I hope so, too. Take care of yourself. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Time for us to say goodbye. On behalf of Michael Cannon and Tom Howey and Tony Nesbitt, the lovely Marilyn Gorelick, myself, the exciting and... not the exciting. Why did I say that? The almost good-looking Norm Nathan Person. Have some interesting people I'd like you to hear tonight. So if you can join us, we'll be talking about some of the Disney works that never got aired or never got featured at all, and a whole bunch of stuff like that, okay? Very happy St. Patrick's Day. Hope it's a good day for you. Bye-bye, old sport from WBZ Boston.
That concludes our March 17th broadcast. We now cut to March 18th.
He's the talk of the town, lifts you up when you're down, Norm Nathan, on WBZ, in Boston.
Hello. Jeekers, but it's really swell to be with you. We'll be here just a couple hours, but hey, we'll make the most of each moment. And a couple of interesting people. One is a man named Steve Daly, who writes for Entertainment Weekly and is the author of a real fun book called Toy Story, The Art and Making of the Animated Film, and will take us behind the scenes and give us the inside story on the production of this history-making motion picture, Toy Story. And also we'll be talking later on with Charles Solomon, who's an animation historian. That's got to be a very specialized field, isn't it? There aren't too many people involved there. An animation historian who has written a book called The Disney That Never Was. So we're going to do a lot of talking about Walt Disney. And we'll get to both these guys in just a minute. I won't brought in some of the greatest names in jazz for an awful lot of years. And we'll talk with Lenny in just a minute. And then we'll talk about Disney right after that. And if this doesn't seem like an action-packed program, I don't know what. I don't know how we're going to get all this swell stuff in a mere 2 hours. But we'll do the best we can, kids. Hello.
Hey, Norm.
Hey, Lenny.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Hey,
it's good to hear your voice. I remember the first time I heard it. Many years ago, you would be selling roast beef sandwiches and stuff,
on a street corner, though.
No, not on a street corner. No, at Lenny's on the Turnpike on Route 1 in Peabody, in the northbound lane. Directly in the northbound lane, but right off of that.
That's right.
And bringing in some of the really great performers. And a lot of people say, whatever happened to Lenny's? I say he married Michelle Pfeiffer and is selling Indian artifacts in a arts and crafts store off of Tierra del Fuego or something like that.
I'd have to work my way through Robert Redford to do that.
Huh? Yeah. Anyway,
I haven't seen so many commercials in a movie. Is Robert Redford and Michelle Pfeiffer lately?
No, I know they've really been promoting that quite a good deal.
Yeah.
And I know that in between, since Lenny's closed, Which was when? Was that back
1972.
Has it been that long?
September 72, 24 years ago, this coming September.
Isn't that amazing? Boy,
are we
getting to be old and decrepit.
I know it. And I sit here talking to you on the telephone, and I remember how many times I drove down Morrissey Boulevard at 1 o'clock in the morning plus with an artist and hanging out with you and Dick.
I know it. With Dick.
WHDA.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. With Dick Erickson.
Yeah.
With the old sounds on the night show. It's amazing how many people remember not only you and the Lennies on the Turnpike. It also remember the old all night show, which has been off the air since 68 or something like that.
I know,
that.
But we'll never forget that sounds tonight because. For one reason, I'm calling tonight is because we associate that show with the Count Basie Orchestra because you used to open and close with it.
That's right. Midnight Blue is
Midnight
my theme
Blue
song.
And Little Darlin'.
Little Darlin' was the Speed Anderson. He used the Count Basie also as his theme.
Yeah.
And he was on another station. I forget which station, but the Speed is a good guy. And he used Little Darlin', and I used Midnight Blue. You've been promoting jazz, even though you haven't had the club since that period of time, and you have something coming up.
Yeah, I have been involved from time to time, Norman.
For a dance, I never would have believed that would have ever happened a few years ago.
It shows you anything can happen.
It shows you that you Jewish guys are really getting hip.
That's right.
I'm going to get some nasty mail about that.
Of course, my association with Basie goes back a few years, as you well know.
I know it does. And your association with just about everybody in jazz goes back
true.
A few years. We were talking on the phone a little earlier today, and you were mentioning all the performers who sang with Basie, for example.
Incredible, huh? Six different vocalists that were featured with the Basie band from the inception of the band in 1935 when it came out of began in Kansas City. Jimmy Rushing and Joe Williams, of course, was a band in the 50s. Bill Henderson sang with the band in the 60s. And, of course, touring with the band, Jimmy Witherspoon and Arthur Prysock. And, of course, O.C. Smith in the 60s made his debut with the Count Basie band.
And these are people who all performed
featured,
at your club.
All featured at the club, right?
Yeah.
Good taste, huh, Norm?
No, you had great taste. I really missed the club a good deal. And,
I know, and you used to be in there, too. I caught you there many times. In fact, I have a bar bill for you.
That's about time I paid up.
I'll catch up with you.
I've often said that we never really appreciated. Well, you had to work hard because you picked up the musicians. They would open on, like a Monday night and play for an entire week, which is...
Monday through Sunday with a matinee on Sunday. Listen, I read the book and I thought Simon Legree was the hero, you know.
No, the fact is that there are no clubs like that now. I mean, there are jazz clubs.
No.
But none where they play seven nights a week.
No.
And they were
glad to get the work, though, Norm.
Yeah, and I lived, I lived right around the corner from where your club was.
That's right.
And, I appreciated you being there, but I should have appreciated it more.
Well, I appreciated Sandy's being there, and I missed the heck out of Sandy's. You know,
they just
I
tore
was over in Beverly.
They just tore the building down.
I know.
That's really sad. I Sandy would have been so unhappy at that.
Well, our building is still was burnt down.
Yeah, I want to one night soon. We have to do a full fledged interview because I want to talk with you about your years, from the time when Lenny's on the Turnpike was known as the place with the hippest jukebox in the world.
The Turnpike Club.
Yeah, the Turnpike Club. That's right. And when you started booking live talent, and all that, and how you went on then to internationally known big jazz people and all of that.
For a review, huh, Norm?
Yeah, we'll have to do that within the next few weeks if that's okay with you, because I'd love to do that.
You know, I was sitting in the Charles Hotel at the Regatta Bar last night, and a young man came over to the table. It never fails when I go into Scholars or the Regatta Bar that somebody doesn't come up to my table and say, "Hey, gee, I used to take my girl to your club, or I used to come to the matinees with my dad. Thank you very much. Get out of here."
No, that's got to be a great thrill. Now, it's got to be a great thrill for you to, because anybody who likes jazz at all, unless they're under the age of 2 months or something, you know, remembers
Lenny. Right, we should do that tonight. I want to make sure that your listeners out there, I know their age bracket is into Count Basie. Anybody who loves blues and loves the ensemble big band sound certainly remembers the Basie band, and that legacy is continuing, Norm, you know. Even though Bill Basie passed away a few years ago, guys like Eric Dixon and Thad Jones and Frank Foster have led the band, and now currently Grover Mitchell will be leading the band into Temple Emmanuel. I hope they've all been bar mitzvahed.
mention again the night this is going
it's
to be going in
the
place. It's
going to take place a week from tonight, Norman, March 24th. And can I tell people where they can get tickets?
You certainly can.
Tickets are available at the Temple, which is on Atlantic Avenue in Marblehead, or at Photographics, a very fine video shop at Vinon Square in Marblehead, Arnold's Art Gallery at in the Old Town of Marblehead. Do you know Gene Arnold does a great jazz series himself during the summer? Mm. And either Sunglass Hut at Liberty Tree Mall or the North Shore Mall.
Excellent. Okay, that's a week from tonight. Temple Emmanuel, which is on what street is that?
Atlantic Avenue.
Atlantic Avenue, because one of the main roads through Marblehead.
Right, and in Marblehead, a quiet little Jewish fishing village,
north of Swampscott.
North of Swampscott. Yeah, that's right. I'm turned around here.
Okay. You're looking at it from the Salem's viewpoint.
If they want to write a telephone number down, Norm, I'll give them this number, 508-745-1140, if they want ticket information.
Okay, 508 is the area code, and then 745-1140.
Right.
And you'll get information.
And it's going to be a great night. It's going to be a great sound on the North Shore, and people will be able to dance and have refreshments. An old-fashioned concert and dance.
That's right. And when you can hear the Count Basie band, by all means, don't miss it when it's so close to us.
1 o'clock jumping at the Woodside, all the oldies plus a few of the new ones.
Great. Excellent. Excellent, Lenny. And we'll be in touch because I do want to talk in great detail some night about all the people that you've met and all the people that you've performed.
Well, I'd love
perform.
That, Norm. You know.
I would like that very much also, Lenny. And good luck. You hope a lot of people
always
get to.
Always a pleasure talking to you, baby.
Okay. Take care of yourself.
Have a good night.
You too, Len. Bye-bye now. Is the staff writer for Entertainment Weekly, author of Toy Story, the art and making of the animated film. And it's a fascinating book, and I'm delighted that you're on the air with us, Steve. Thank you very much. And thank you for hanging in there, too. I appreciate that.
Sure thing. Well, any jazz plug is of interest to me.
Are you a jazz fan?
I should be much more educated about it, but I'm rather uneducated, but I am a fan.
No, if you're a fan, that's okay, because the education comes along as long as the interest is there. I appreciate that, because I used to do a jazz show a few years back, and it's still the kind of music that I love a great deal.
You know, a fellow here at Entertainment Weekly whose name is David Haydu, who is a general editor here, has written a book about Billy Strayhorn.
Oh, really?
Out in a couple of months. Yeah, a really terrific piece of work.
Oh, the great Duke Ellington side man. And,
correct.
And composer, not only just side man, but
correct.
Composer. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he wrote a lot of things that people think Duke Ellington wrote, because they sort of wrote in a similar vein some magnificent stuff. Now, what is the book called?
It's called Lush Life.
Oh, Lush Life.
I'm sure my editor would be thrilled. I'm here on the air giving him a plug.
Because
it's coming out in a couple of months.
Okay, Lush Life by Billy Strayhorn. I got to dig that up.
Oh, the author's name is David Haydu, but it's a biography of Billy Strayhorn.
Okay, now, how do you spell Haydu?
H-A-J-D-U. I don't know if it's Czechoslovakian or he's of some Eastern heritage.
Okay, we'll have to look at it because Billy's Lush Life was one of the great jazz classics. There were a whole series of drinking kind of songs about people who took to drink because they had unhappy love lives.
Well, Strayhorn was a terrible alcoholic. In fact, he lost his stomach late in life. He literally was on some sort of, you know, almost ghastly sort of intestinal hookup where he, you know, it ruined him, the alcohol.
Oh, I never realized that. I thought Lush Life. Well, obviously that was about drinking, but I thought the emphasis there was more on some poor soul who had lost his love.
Oh, yes. I mean, I was making the leap to what happened to him later in life. He always was a fan of alcohol, and it caught up with him after a while.
Okay.
That's a complicated story.
Hey,
it's pronounced Hey-Do, even though there's a J. Hey-Do.
Okay, the J is silent. Hey-Do, Lush Life, the story of Billy Strayhorn. Well, I will dig that up, and maybe we can even get in touch with Hey-Do and talk about that on the air for one future night.
I'm sure he'd be happy to.
Anyway, your book is fascinating. You have a kind of a three, not a kind of a, but a 3D cover on it. A big, big book with some great, great illustrations and all. And the story of the Toy Story, not only the finished product, you have a lot of pictures of that, but the sketches from the storyboard and stuff as that was leading up to it. And the first animated film of its kind, isn't it? The first computer animated full-length motion picture.
That's right. It's the first full-length animated film made entirely on computers.
Yeah, because I'm old enough to remember when Snow White came out, which was the first. Was that the first full-length animated film?
Well, Charles Solomon actually could probably tell you exactly what the competing titles were. There were one or two other feature-length films, but they weren't American, and they really had, I think one was what they call a silhouette film, possibly made by someone, either a German or a, I don't know if it was German, Czech, or Russian, but there was someone who had attempted one that was, it wasn't of the level of endeavor that Snow White was, but for all intents and purposes, Snow White was the first commercial American animated feature. It was certainly the first musical full-length animated feature that I know of.
And the first one that was done as well as it was done. I remember a man named Max Fleischman was putting out some...
Fleischer, his name
was. Oh, Fleischer, not that's Fleischman. Right. Fleischer, that's right, too. He had a film out, but none of them... There was a flair to the Disney films that was different than any other animated film at all. And you kind of would expect that the Disney people would come out with the first computer animated the full-length motion picture, Toy Story, which was that a risky kind of thing? It turned out well and has done, I guess it's done well. I hear all kinds of great things about it.
Well, again, you know, Norm, I'm a little prejudiced because I spent a lot of time with dozens and dozens of artists. I mean, I think there's a staff of about 110 who actually put this film together, and I was lucky enough to spend a good chunk of time with them as we were putting the book together, not as much as everyone might have liked, but enough to get all the flavor into the book. In fact, the movie is a collaboration between the Walt Disney Studios, who produced it, put up the money for it, and supervised the development of it. But it is, in fact, the actual work of a small little studio called Pixar Productions that is hundreds of miles away from Los Angeles, up outside of San Francisco in the East Bay. And the company, the creative director of the film end of the company, the filmmaking end of the company, is a fellow named John Lasseter, who in fact had been an animator at the Disney Studios back in the early 80s. And he saw a movie called Tron back in the early 80s that he wasn't working on, but he saw some of the computer effects, and he was so impressed by it that he decided that he wanted to work in that medium. And at the time, this was before Michael Eisner had taken over the management of the Walt Disney Company, and the company was sort of in probably the lowest creative state it had ever been in, and they really weren't interested in, they could barely turn out a conventional animated film, let alone jumping into this other realm. So the Walt Disney Company did sort of take a chance. They financed this film to be made by a small company that had never made a film longer than 3 or 4 minutes, and none of them had ever had any dialogue. John Lasseter's films, he won an Academy Award for a short called Tin Toy back, I'm not sure if it was 88 or 89, and the Pixar studio has won a number of technical awards for improvements they've made to camera techniques for regular animation where you draw with a pencil and then you transfer it into a digital ink and paint environment. That digital system for coloring in the drawings is something that Pixar created with the Walt Disney Company. But yeah, no, it was kind of like Snow White. I mean, you spoke about it before. Nobody knew, you know, will people sit still for an hour and a half of something that no human hand has actually touched? You know, they didn't want to make it a gimmick. They wanted to have a good, strong story. And they spent a heck of a long time doing it.
Yeah, because you mentioned that they did want a story, and they wanted people to identify, you know, in a human kind of way with these characters and all of that, so the people wouldn't feel they were sitting there watching some kind of a gimmicky thing. I just wondered, was there any one individual who said, yeah, let's go ahead with that? That would be, that had to be an awfully brave choice to make.
Well, you have to look at this as it wasn't the only type of that decision that Disney made at the time. This was in the early, well, I guess actually it started a little before 1991. Disney was having a tremendous success putting all their old films out on home video. And they could see, even back in 89 and 90, that within 5 or 6 years, they were going to be through that catalog. They would have released every one of their vintage movies and made a pile of money on home video. And if they wanted to have product in the pipeline to release to theaters and on video, and also to have fresh characters that could tie into the theme parks and merchandising and all the other divisions of the company that depend on the movies first and foremost, they were going to have to turn to outside producers, because in decades and decades of trying, they'd still never been able to make more than one animated film every 2 years. They were barely keeping to that schedule. And so in the early 90s, with Michael Eisner's approval, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who of course is no longer at the Walt Disney Company, but he supervises a traditional feature animation branch that is now very ably headed by a fellow named Peter Schneider and another fellow named Tom Schumacher, who always ran the division, even when Katzenberg was supervising the entire output of the Walt Disney Studios. They decided to turn to some outside producers to produce other kinds of animated films to supplement their traditional animated features like The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. And that was when they made a decision to turn to Pixar, based mostly on the strength of the computer animation scene that was done for Beauty and the Beast, the ballroom scene, which every audience that sees that picture at some point or another winds up talking about how wonderful that scene was.
Yes.
And another thing that happened that same year was that Terminator 2 came out, the James Cameron movie. And in that movie was a robot character who had been produced primarily with computer animation. And the movie was such an enormous hit and made such an impression on people that the moment seemed right to take a chance on building an entire movie around computer-generated characters. And that's why the Walt Disney Company, which had been flirting with Pixar, they had tried to hire John Lasseter away. They said, you know, why don't you come down? You can direct for us. And he said, no, I like the company I'm at. I like the work I'm doing. And I want to work in computer animation. I don't want to go back to traditional animation. And he stuck to his guns. And they finally came to Pixar and said, we will make an agreement with you to finance the films, and we'll control the merchandising and the release, but you will actually produce the film. And that's what happened.
What were the major problems that they went through while making this film? At first, you were saying, you had written in the book, that there are kind of a lot of individual scenes that maybe weren't tied together enough, or there wasn't a proper flow, or... everything they did, though, everything that was done for this film was done like for the very first time. And I wondered what kind of problems you face when there are no guidelines, really. You're making your own.
Well, you know, we started work on the book last, a little over a year ago. And at the time, it was just about the time when everyone at the studio was finally, it was finally sinking into them that this movie was really going to work. They were just beginning to see finished footage, because computer animation is done in a sort of hierarchical series of steps where the first thing you see when you're working as an animator are these incredibly rough, sort of abstracted versions of the characters you're working on. Mm. So you got executives looking month after month at these stick figures, and it's very difficult to imagine what the finished product is going to look like. In fact, if you look at the book and see what those early, what they call polygonals, you know, they're made out of polygons, you look at it and you think, this is, you know, what the heck, this is, looks like a child drew it.
Yes.
It's very hard to imagine the finished product. And that was a tremendous pressure on these people all through the process. It's hard enough to make any kind of an animated feature work because so much depends on the voice actors, on the gestures, on weaving a good story together. Weaving a good story together is very difficult in any medium. But in this medium, where you really don't know how much the visuals are going to affect what your story is, it was doubly difficult. And I think because they were under so much pressure and so much scrutiny, they had a harder, even harder time of it than some of the Disney traditional features have had. There's always a point where the story can get difficult. I mean, on Beauty and the Beast and on Aladdin, there were points in the development of those films where literally almost everything that a team had spent 1 or 2 years making was thrown out.
Hmm.
At one point, Jeffrey Katzenberg sat down and looked at Aladdin, I think about a year before it was actually completed, and said, "This is junk. Nothing's working. The main character is uninteresting. He's absent. He's not even in his own movie. We've got a mother character who's uninteresting. We've got a genie who's terrific but doesn't show up till halfway through the picture." And he basically threw out half the movie. The same thing happened with Lion King, which was put through some 11 or 12 previews. While they really fine-tuned and honed, basically rewrote the ending 3 or 4 times. And the same thing happened to Toy Story. After about a year of story development, they were just about to begin final animation, you know, or to begin the animation process of the entire film, which first is done just on sketches, on little sheets of paper that look like index cards, like if you were writing a term paper back in college. They stick those up on bulletin boards, and then they photograph those as little still frames, and they run a dummy soundtrack to it in order to see, well, here's roughly what the finished movie is going to be like. And they try and work out as much as they can before they actually animate it, because it's incredibly time-consuming and expensive to throw away any finished animation. The goal is, don't ever animate anything until you're certain it's going to work and it's going to be in the movie. Well, when they put together their first version of what they call those story reels, it was a disaster. Tom Hanks had already been hired as the voice of Woody, this little ragdoll cowboy that this little boy has, who is very jealous of another toy called Buzz, who's a spaceman, who's voiced by Tim Allen. And in the early versions of these stories, Woody, the idea was that Woody was a character who was going to find redemption. He was a very jealous, immature kind of guy who tries to get rid of a competitor and winds up having to work with this guy, you know, in the classic tradition of a buddy picture. And he's reformed. He turns out to be a helpful guy by the end of the film. Well, the theory they tried was, well, if he's going to turn into a nice guy, let's start out by having him be a jerk. And the character was such a jerk that in November of 1993, John Lasseter and a number of the producers, Ralph Guggenheim, Bonnie Arnold, and a number of other key creative people went down to the Disney studios and sat down with Tom Schumacher, Peter Schneider, Jeffrey Katzenberg, I believe Michael Eisner may also have been one of the people to look at it. And John Lasseter, who's, by the way, the co-author of the book, he recounted to me sinking down into his seat lower and lower and lower as this first story reel was unspooled for these executives who were putting up close to $30 million. To make this movie. And he said, "Steve, it was terrible. We were the first people to agree, this is just a disaster. We have a main character that you don't even want to see for 5 minutes, let alone an hour and a half."
Oh, dear.
And Disney said, "This is so bad that we're shutting down production until you rework the script. And you've got 3 months." It wasn't quite presented as an ultimatum, but the deal was, you know, there's only so many costs we can keep floating. And there was a lot of tussling back and forth. Look, you know, if you shut down production now, we're going to lose all these animators. Computer graphics is a very hot field. We're going to lose talented people. And the Disney execs had to say, look, we know that that's a problem, but if you don't have a story to animate, you can't animate. So for 3 months, every day of the week, they worked and worked and worked. They worked over Christmas. They worked over New Year's. And by mid-February, they had pretty much junked the entire first third of their original draft and completely changed around the opening scene, deleted a couple of supporting characters, re-recorded all the dialogue, giving Tom Hanks completely different line readings and, in many cases, completely different dialogue. And it wasn't quite fixed by February of 94, but it was close enough that the studio said, okay, we can see that this is going to work now. And
because even at that point, to say, yeah, it's been reworked and it's going to, things seem to be working out okay now. To say that is something, too, because you're talking about a product that has never been done before on that scale. I know you mentioned that, you know, these computer animations have been done 3 or 4 minute things, commercials, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, and it's unknown territory in every way. Here's an action movie. Okay, it's a comedy and an action movie. It's a buddy movie. That's never been done as a cartoon. Another huge creative risk. This is not really a musical. And this was a major tussle between Pixar and the Walt Disney Company. The Pixar folks did not want to make a musical. You know, a form that Disney has had tremendous success with. And the creative solution that was come up with was that the movie would have songs that are called song over action, where the music sort of comments on what's going on, but is not actually sung by a character in the film. Nobody knew if that was going to work. And in fact, many people at Pixar were like, you know, why do we have to stop the movie dead in its tracks? You know, we're not trying to make a musical. We want to make a buddy movie in cartoon form. And what they kept arguing was, you don't understand, this stuff looks so photorealistic that the audience is going to accept it as an action movie. And again, it's always difficult to have hindsight before you've put the thing together. I think there was a lot of worry that, you know, if this doesn't come off looking the way we hope, this better darn well have some music, because that's been so important in getting a general audience to relate to an animated film. So it was a very, you know, I think that people on both sides very passionately, Disney was adamant that it be a musical, and some of the key creative people were adamant that it not be. And I think they worked out a much better compromise than I think either side thought was going to happen when they started.
Yeah, but certainly.
And that, you know, they're up for Academy Awards for best score and best song. I don't think anybody thought that was going to happen when they got started.
That's kind of wild. Let me just take it along. And Steve is the co-author of a book on the Walt Disney film Toy Story, The Art of Making of the Animated Film, and of course the first ever computer animated full-length motion picture. And I always admire anybody who's ever connected with the first ever anything. As you mentioned, you know, they're going into the whole world of the unknown, and it is so nice. It's turned out well for them.
It's turned out more than well. It's kind of staggering. I think this film will. I think it's at about 185 million domestic U.S. box office at this point. I'm not certain whether there's a reissue coming after the Academy Awards. The film will win a special technical award for John Lasseter that's already been announced that he'll get on Oscar night. And they're up for 3 Academy Awards, including Best Original Screenplay, which I agree is a much-deserved nomination. And they actually have they might have a shot at that because it's adapted screenplay that probably will be won by Emma Thompson. I don't think in their wildest dreams Pixar realized it would. They thought they had a success, but I think they thought maybe they'd top out at about $100 million, and they've done, a good $60 million. Well, when the final tally is counted, they'll probably do a good $60 million more business than Pocahontas did, and that is a source of immense satisfaction to the people at Pixar, because they were the little engine that could.
That's true. As you mentioned earlier, and I just mentioned this for people who may not have heard the beginning of all this. Steve Daly was mentioning that Pixar is a film company that's north, a good deal north of Los Angeles, up in the San Francisco area. You mentioned who have made these kind of computer animated films, but short ones, mostly commercials, I guess, and little short 3-4 minute things. This is the first time they've been involved in a whole full length thing. And you were talking about stopping production at one point because it didn't look like it was going well, according to the authorities at Disney and all that. And suddenly they've come out with this incredible success in an area of an unknown area, doing something that nobody has ever done before of this length. How does this affect Pixar in the future? Will they be doing more of these kind of films? They still can't be a small little animated, computer animated film company up in San Francisco.
Well, believe it or not, they are. One of the revolutionary things about this movie that I think scares the bejesus out of traditional animators, although there's a lot of talk and noise about, oh, no, traditional animation will coexist with computers, which is true. I mean, traditional animation has been so enormously successful for the Walt Disney Company, it's not going away. But this movie took almost 4 years to make, and it involved only 110 people. Disney's traditional animated features take almost that long. They take between 3 and 4 years each, but they involve 700 people. And it doesn't take a mathematical genius or a computer scientist to figure out that that's a lot bigger payroll. Toy Story really only came in, I think, under $30 million. When these big super productions like Pocahontas, the final tallies I was reading was that movie was in the neighborhood of $50 million just to produce and not to market. When a movie can cost almost half and makes as much or more, you're going to keep working on in that vein.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what they've done. Disney was shrewd enough to pretty much, insist with Pixar that they enter into a 3-picture contract, which the Walt Disney Company had the right to break at any point, I believe, or break in the sense of if Pixar didn't come up with another idea that Disney approved, Disney had the right to say, no, this idea isn't good enough, and we will, or, basically they were covered. They had a way out of the contract, but with the movie such an enormous success, everyone's very keen to continue it, especially Disney, because they're financially in a pretty good position about this, and they're already deep in production on the second computer animated feature, which I know that there's no other company that's going to get a computer animated feature out before them. So they not only have produced the first, they almost certainly will produce the second ever computer animated feature. It's called Bugs. And it's essentially a take on the grasshopper and the ant. It's about a little group of ants in a backyard who are beset by grasshoppers who keep stealing their food and their provisions. And they hire a troop of fierce bugs to protect them, very much like the Magnificent Seven and the Seven Samurai. That's sort of the idea that it's taken off from. And that is due Thanksgiving of 98, if everything continues to go on track, which is never guaranteed in animation.
No, but I would imagine that people are going to be a little more reluctant to object to things in this film.
That is the hope. The people at Pixar are hoping, we've gone the distance. We've taken every punch you could throw at us. And again, the Pixar people are the first to say, if it were not for the story development expertise of some people at Disney, this movie wouldn't be nearly as good as it was. I mean, as a number of the story people pointed out to me, that lousy first version that we threw up on Reels in November 93, if this were any other company but the Walt Disney Company, that picture would have gotten made exactly as it was, and it would have been lousy.
Mm.
The Walt Disney Company, you know, has the money, and more importantly, it has the leadership to recognize that it is worth spending 2 years to develop a good story, and it's worth spending that money because in the long run you get something so much better. And they're willing to retool the picture, they're willing to throw out parts of it that don't work. Those are difficult and expensive decisions. And it takes not just, it isn't just a fiscal talent. It takes genuine creative talent to do that. And this is something that, you know, Walt Disney had when he was still alive, and that he has managed to inculcate into other people. And I don't mean to be a booster for them, but I genuinely feel that there is a devotion to quality there that is not, that is very hard to achieve.
We're going to be talking during the next hour with Charles Solomon, who has written a book called The Disney That Never Was. This kind of Disney night. Your story about the Toy Story, your book is a beautiful book and so much fun to read, Steve Daly. I really appreciate you coming on with us. Hyperion Publishers in New York has published the book, and it's beautiful to look at, and it's a great deal of fun to read and very exciting. Again, about the very first computer animated full length motion picture. You told the story well, and you've got some great pictures in that. I would guess that kind of a book is. Should be available most anywhere for people who want to pick it up.
Just look for that big 3D cover in any chain bookstore, or better yet, go to your local bookseller and give them the business.
That's right. Thank you. And the book written by Steve Daly, along with I forget his first
John
name.
John Lasseter. You'll see him on the Academy Awards on March 25th. There he'll be.
We'll be looking for him.
Accepting a statuette.
Okay. Hey, thanks a million, Steve. You're a fascinating man, and the book is great, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Sure thing. It's a pleasure.
Take care. Bye.
Okay.
But I often wondered about the fact that Walt Disney has been so successful through the years, the Disney Studios have, with their animated productions and now their computer animated production of the Toy
Story.
Why are there not, you think, other animated features by other studios? Nobody really has ever tried to, not directly copy Walt Disney, but nobody has done quite the kind of things that he has done.
Well, I think a lot of the problem has been that people have tried to copy Disney instead of trying to copy his spirit, which was always to do something new and original. There have been a lot of animated features, especially in recent years, but very few of them have been very good. And you look at a number of them and you can see, okay, they're trying to do Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast here. They're trying to do this effect from another Disney film there. Instead of just sitting down and working out a story that needs animation to tell it.
For example, I've not seen other animated, full-length animated films. Maybe I've missed them, but I haven't seen them outside of the Disney studios.
There have been some, and you haven't missed much, frankly. Quite a few of them have come and gone very, very quickly. In fact, several times over the last couple decades, up until this new sort of golden age, as people sometimes talk about it, there were periodic critical articles that would appear saying the animated feature was dead, that this last spate of films did so poorly that, you know, the medium isn't valid anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And so at the same time, they were also always predicting, well, we're going to have a renaissance soon, and there are these new people coming up. So you had a medium that was simultaneously dying and undergoing a renaissance. Made for a very strange situation for a number of years.
Now, I had the off-the-air woman had called. She was an animator, she said.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a little concerned because she felt maybe the computer animation, like in Toy Story, which was so successful, and which is obviously cheaper than a totally animated film, that it's with animators and artists and so on, that might replace animation as we know it. Do you think it will, or will they both work hand in hand?
Not at all. In the first place, I don't know that doing a film in computer animation is any cheaper than doing it in hand-drawn, particularly not a film of the quality of Toy Story. But I don't see computer animation replacing hand-drawn animation any more than photography replaced painting. You know, they're two different media, and they have different strengths and different weaknesses. What I think is the most exciting thing to come along with that technology is the use of combining computer graphics and hand-drawn animation to create something that otherwise you'd never be able to put on the screen. An example of that is the wildebeest stampede in The Lion King, where you started out with one hand-animated wildebeest, and they were able to turn it into that enormous herd stampeding over the cliff. No one could have ever drawn that by hand, obviously. And if you had tried to do it purely in computer, it probably would have been stiffer and less convincing, instead of having that believable kind of animal motion that it had. So another example would be the ballroom sequence in Beauty and the Beast, where suddenly you're swept into this kind of magical world that's different from the rest of the film. This is what excites me as someone who has to look at and write about animation often, this, the possibility of just creating new visuals and giving the artists more tools to give us things that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I remember the Disney Studios also combining live action and animation. I guess that hasn't been done in too many Disney films, but the Uncle Remus stories.
Yes, the Song of the South.
Yes.
And also in some of the wartime films. The ones about South America, where Donald would dance with the South American women singing and dancing to some of the songs from that area.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking of Gene Kelly now that you mentioned that.
Anchors Away.
Anchors Away has that memorable scene.
Yeah, Tom and Jerry dancing with Gene Kelly, which was animated by Hanna and Barbera before they went on to become... do all the Saturday morning stuff.
Yeah, I just had talked in the first hour of the program with Steve Daly, who has written a book called Toy Story, The Art and Making of the Animated Film. And he did say that that this computer animation did cost a good deal less, or employed a lot less people than straight animation would cost. That's why I mentioned that that I thought the computer animated stuff was not quite as expensive as animation, and went wondering whether if that were true, would that cut down on the animation and all go to computer animation? I guess you pretty much answered that anyway, saying that's you don't believe that's true.
No, at this point, and I think you can see it even by. Looking at Toy Story, there are some things that computer animation does very, very effectively. The stuff of the toys and Andy's room and so forth is charming and very believable. The human characters, I think, are somewhat less successful, and they don't have the kind of warmth that you can create with a hand-drawn character. And also, I don't think... Toy Story was a success because it's the first computer film where the people went to see the technology. I think it was a successful film because they had such a well put together story that was told so effectively. And as long as you can give people, a good story well told, I think you'll have a successful film.
Well, now, what about animation in the shorter films? I'm thinking about, I don't know whether they were Warner Brothers films, the ones we used to see Saturday afternoon and showed up on television
later. Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam and so forth.
Right, that kind of stuff. Are those still being put out?
Very few of them. That's a very sad story of short-sightedness on the part of the studio management back in the 50s. Up until then, there'd been a practice in this country known as block booking. If you were a theater owner and wanted the equivalent of Star Wars from my studio, you would also have to take a second feature and a newsreel and a cartoon and maybe a serial. Well, in around 1950, the Supreme Court declared that practice illegal. And up until then, the animated films like the Bugs Bunny shorts and so forth had been paid for by a percentage of revenues from the rentals of the whole package. Well, at that point, theater owners were very eager to get in as many shows as they could, and they wanted to shorten the program so they wouldn't pay very much for the cartoons. And they realized that a cartoon had gotten expensive enough to make that it couldn't earn back its total cost on its first release. What they didn't realize is that a good cartoon can be re-released essentially forever. As we know, you look at one of the Bugs Bunny cartoons from the early 50s today, and it's still hysterical. And people still love them, and they're on TV, and they're on cassettes, and they're on laser discs. And so the studio owners closed their studios, and that was pretty much the demise of the animated short cartoon.
Oh, has it been tougher as an animator to get work these days then and over the past several years than there used to be? There are fewer of them working?
No, these days there are more of them working. The success of the recent Disney features has gotten a lot of people in Hollywood saying, hey, they're making a lot of money on this medium. So in addition to Disney, you have DreamWorks with Katzenberg and Spielberg and Geffen. Warner Brothers formed an animation unit not too long ago that's working on a couple features. Don Bluth is supposed to be working on at least two features for Fox in Phoenix. And so for the first time in many years, it's really a seller's market for animators. And now the top animators, can pretty much call their own shots, and they're bid on by the different studios, and they go where they want to work depending on who's offering the most money and who's offering more often the most interesting projects. So after many years of drought, suddenly animators are very much in demand. And one of the limits on how many animated features we see is the fact that there simply aren't that many really good animators, the kind of artist who can take a character like Beast or Pocahontas and make that character act through an entire film believably. There are very few artists who can do that. And so that kind of puts a cap on how many quality animated films that can be made at this point.
Was Walt Disney, was he the first to do the kind of animation? I'll see if I can phrase this right. You probably know what I'm going to ask anyway, and maybe I don't even have to finish the question, but they were not animating the same way before Disney as they did, as they have done since. I wondered how he, the kind of, looking ahead, or the kind of perception he had to know that this was going to work out, because nobody had done it quite the way he had done it.
No, Disney was someone who always wanted to take risks and go a step further and see what was beyond. He never wanted to repeat anything.
That interview was just getting started. I checked the archives and could not find another tape that may have included the remainder of it. But I thought what was covered was very enjoyable. Gee, whomever booked Norm's show always did a great job. Please like, subscribe, and share from whichever platform you're listening on. Until next week, closing the vault and writing those animated pages home. For Migrating Birds, San Juan Capistrano, St. Patrick, Motown, Community Auditions, Breaking in New Producers, Illustrious Radio Careers, Richard Dreyfuss, Riverdance, the former Henry Moscovich, Sidewalk Games, Schlemiels and Schlemazels, Philip Roth, Lord Briscoe, Senor Salimene, High Speed Trains, Old Time Radio, Henry Morgan, Fred Allen, Jack Benny, Fibber McGee and Molly, Burns and Allen, Vic and Sade, Bob and Ray, Lenny Sogoloff and Lenny's on the Turnpike, Tierra del Fuego, Midnight Blue, Speed Anderson, Sandy's and Beverly, Steve Daly, Charles Solomon, Walt Disney, Pixar, Dave Bowers, Tom Howie, Mike Cannon, Marilyn Gorelnick, and the host of the hippest radio show in the nation, Norm Nathan. I'm Tony Nesbitt.